Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. One of the notable things about this new music industry, this do-it-yourself music industry, is that a musician suddenly has to be proficient at much more than simply playing their instrument. A person has to be a social media marketer, a graphic designer, a computer expert, a streamer, a dreamer, a socializer, a creative whiz kid, even, in fact, a brand. Good for us, though, that the brand I'm talking to today, I mean the person I'm talking to today, is more than qualified at all those things. Brian Platter is a soft-spoken graphic designer by day and an extroverted kick-ass shredder by night. I enjoyed talking to him about so many things, amps and melodic death metal and the Joker and crowdfunding and his family and Stevie Ray Vaughan, which brings me to my next point. Jordan Ranick and Tyler Walsh are two of my SUNY Fredonia music industry students. They co-produced and mixed this episode, and I want to thank them for their great work. So now, sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Brian the WizKid Platter. Brian Platter, this is your old friend Al Pipitone.
Yeah, going on 30 years?
Well, I was thinking today, I've known your family longer than you have. Go figure.
You knew Debbie before I was born?
Well, actually, no, maybe that's wrong.
I was born in 82.
Okay, so no, I take that back. You. So let me rephrase that. You've known your family longer than I have.
Right, right.
And I remember when you were a little boy, probably like, I want to say like 13 years old. I think I remember your room. Didn't you have a cat named Snowball?
Yeah.
And You had like a bunch of videos, really well organized, games maybe, or movies, I think, right?
And CDs, all of the above. I still have collections of stuff all alphabetized. I don't know why everybody's always so amazed that everything's alphabetized.
Obviously, I remembered it, like, because, you know, my mom does the same thing with her books. And I did once with my book collection, and it feels so good when you're done. Now, every time since then, I've grabbed a book out, and I don't really put it back in the right place, but...
See, I'm kind of like OCD, basically, so I can't not have it where it was supposed to
really?
Go.
Really? And if somebody else, like, just say I came over to your house and took a CD off the shelf and looked at it, I put it back in the wrong place, what would your reaction be?
I think if I saw you do it, I would have been like, fix that.
Oh my God, I love that. All right, so.
I actually had, I don't know if you know this, but I had Snowball for 18 years.
You did?
Yeah. I had a. Put him down in 2012.
I had Foxy for 18 years. Remember Foxy Brown, my dog?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Little Fox, yeah. It's so hard. So, Brian, I wanted to talk to you about a lot of things, all things music. But, in fact, what I sort of wanted to do today is sort of focus on your latest project, because I find it very important how you were able, you and your band, The Last Rain, were able to put together a Kickstarter project and make it be successful and see it through. So I think my first interest with you here today would be, I actually want to talk about that whole process. I know how much work it is.
Yeah.
I know what it entails to do it right.
Just doing music in general. You're well aware.
Exactly. So let's start with this. So you guys, you wanted to make a new album with The Last Rain, correct? And so you decided that the best way was to try a crowdfunding project, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's my thought process when it comes to doing a Kickstarter is that it acts more of like a pre-order than anything else, as opposed to like just trying to ask for money from people, you know, where, you know, it benefits them to get the stuff early, because you're going to get the stuff at a discounted price, like the bundle you got and things like that.
I hear what you're saying, and I totally identify with it, because what I hear you doing is what I do too, which is sort of like trying to justify why you're asking people for money up front. And it's, I think I hear you because I did the same thing when I've done two Kickstarter projects. And so in our minds, I think we have to sort of sell it when in fact, that's upside down. Like I was so happy when I got an email saying, hey, we're doing a Kickstarter project. I was just so excited just to be able to support the project. And I'm sure 100% of the people feel like that. Now, bonus, when I got your merch, holy kick ass. It's so cool. when I listened to the album, holy kick ass. So let's just Thanks. Start at the beginning. You decided to do this crowdfunding project, which if people don't know, like you, the band, you choose an amount you want to go for, what you need to make a project. Then you sort of offer different tiers of rewards, as we call them. So if somebody pledges $50, they're going to get a CD and a couple t-shirts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the stressor there is that if you don't reach your goal, like just say you set it for 10,000 and you raise 8,000 in pledges, you don't get any of the money.
Right, yeah. That's where like a site like Indiegogo is different, where you get any of the proceeds that come in, whether you hit the goal or not. So that's where a benefit is of maybe going with Indiegogo. I personally haven't used it. I've just chosen, like we did it with Pollock too, where we kept the goal relatively low, where it's like, it'll help our wallets. So we're not putting out as much when we order everything.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a low enough number where we weren't concerned about hitting it. There was also discussion in the band that no matter what the goal was, if we got close, we were just going to put the rest of the money in. So we got all the other rewards.
Yeah, because the thing is, I like the argument that Kickstarter puts out because they say they don't want the artist being in the position of people gave you $5,000 and you actually needed $7,500 to do this project. Now you've gotten all this money and you can't fulfill the order. So like, I get it. I get that why it's a good model for them to only, you only get the money if you hit your goal. I like that model, right?
Sure.
But 30 some percent of people make their goal. Like most people don't make it. So you set your goal from your conversations in your band. You were pretty confident that you were going to make the goal, but you offered a lot of cool merch. Like tell me about the amount of work that goes into the whole project. Can you sort of walk me through how that happens?
Well, you know, it obviously starts from what we want to give out. Obviously it starts with the CD and, you know, use stickers and the normal, merch that you would have. And we threw in a couple, you know, actually it was kind of neat where one of the things that I tasked my band with was to kind of sit down and come up with a bunch of different reward tiers. And so, you know, from there, obviously we needed still the shirt designs, which that is obviously falls to me. But we knew we wanted to do hoodies. We knew we wanted an album shirt, but then I wanted to do an exclusive Kickstarter shirt as well. So those were three easy ones. Then the beanies were another option that we were thinking about adding. And then we just kind of clumped those all together in different bundles. And then we did there were some fun ideas that we had where you'd get basically 100% of the merchandise, but then for like another $150 or $200 or something like that, it would be like one of five different things where it's like you could appear in a music video. You could get a music lesson from one of us in the band. You could... actually, of the big ones, there was two people that donated on the one where. So we're going to be doing an 80s EP this summer where we're going to be doing covers of 80s pop songs, like melodic death versions of 80s pop songs. And so one of the tiers was they could pick what those songs were going to be. We did actually get two people on that. So we have that the songs we're going to be doing are Careless Whisper, Separate Ways by Journey, obviously, and Power of Love, Huey Lewis.
Dude, so you're doing death metal versions of those 80s songs?
Yeah, we already have two in the bank.
Uh-huh.
And then we're working on Power of Love right now. What's the... Moving Pictures Never, which is the song from Footloose.
Oh, God.
and there's another one, a super obscure one my friend donated on. It's this band called Icicle Works, a song called Birds Fly. So it'll be super weird, but hopefully people will enjoy it.
Those are fun, creative projects. You can have whatever ideas you want, you know? That's the cool thing.
Yeah, it is. I was just talking to a friend of mine recently, and like back maybe 20, probably even less than 20 years ago, I always thought like people that do cover bands and stuff like that, I was like, I would never be that person. Although I did that Chili Peppers tribute band, but I've always thought, you know, tribute bands are a little different than cover bands. But, you know, breaching on 40, like, I get it now. I get it why people stop bothering to create original music, especially when it comes to metal.
Why? Can you tell me why? Because I think that's important.
Well, it's not harder creating it. It's harder doing everything you need to do to back it, which obviously involves recording. It involves artwork, it involves CDs, it involves marketing and social media. And it's like a full-time job, basically. Even some of the relatively bigger metal bands still don't make like a living off of it. You know, even ones that tour like year round. I'm not talking about Metallica, but like some of the middle of the road, bigger metal bands still don't make a ton of money.
I get that. I talked to Ryan Scarrett a few episodes ago, and
you're really,
yeah, mutual friend of ours. And he said the same thing. Now, interesting, because
he got out of the music scene, right?
Yeah, he's on a hiatus, put it that way. I always tell people you're never really out of the music scene.
I know, right?
You know, from what I always understood, like the metal genre still can follow the old school model of make an album, tour on the album, make an album, tour on that. Like the fans still go for that model. It comes back to trying to make a living, which is really actually the reason why I started this podcast, because I knew so many people who are so talented, and yet it's a grind. And we ask ourselves sometimes, why am I doing this again? Right?
Yeah.
I wanted to say though about the design, like I know you're a graphic designer. You are so, I've always told you this, you're so talented at that. The hoodie I got from you from that Kickstarter project and the two t-shirts, so cool, man. You really, like,
thank you.
I want to encourage everybody to go to, what's your website? The Last Rain?
Yep, just thelastrain.com. And we actually just opened up a merch store on it, so you can actually buy it directly through our website.
That's cool. And that's R-E-I-G-N, like a rain, like a king or queen.
Right.
Okay, so the project, so this whole Kickstarter project, what time commitment was that from you?
I would say it was a year for the Kickstarter itself. See, the album is actually about 4 years in the making. So I don't know how much you remember the history, but so the lineup I have right now is a different lineup from the original incarnation of the band. The band started in 2015, and for about 2 years, I had a general lineup, and we played shows, we did a tour, and we released our first album, Expulsion from Paradise. And then through a series of unfortunate events, everybody skedaddled. And, late summer 2017, that left me with my thumb up my ass.
You were actually at that point the literal last rain.
Right. But I had already written most of this entire second album before them leaving. So, and I didn't feel I could let it go, because this, of all the bands I've been in and all the original music I've created, this is by far the best stuff I've ever written. And it sucks that it came so far late in my life, but I couldn't. It was, I don't know, it's just this, other bands that didn't work out, I would just start a new project and new music, and I couldn't let it go. So flash forward to 2019, finally put together a lineup, and did a few shows, went out of town a little bit. You know, we didn't necessarily want to release Evolution during a pandemic, but I also didn't want to wait another year on top of the four that I was already sitting on this new music. Mm-hmm. It did suck, though, because we started recording out in Rochester in late February, and then the world shut down a month later. So we ended up having to do a lot of the extra recording stuff on our own. Luckily, we had gotten all the drums done. So then once we had the album done and had the final masters, then that was when we started discussing Kickstarter stuff. So there was already in the back of my mind that I wanted to do a Kickstarter for it, because I do think it's, especially during a pandemic, we can't even play shows to sell the new merch. So I feel, but then there was also the conversation that came up is like, well, because it's a pandemic, will that reflect poorly on us? And I'm like, I don't, I don't think so. And it didn't end up having that adverse effect at all. But yeah, so I'd say the Kickstarter process was at least a couple months with putting together all the tiers, making the artwork. We ran the Kickstarter for about just under 4 weeks.
Were you ever biting your nails about, are we going to make it or not? I know you said you guys were going to, you know, make up any difference, but still, isn't it? To me, it's always a nail biter. I was like, oh my God, did you feel nervous?
No, the guys kind of were. I wasn't really worried about making. Our goal was only $2,500, so I wasn't really concerned. It's a weird thing because that was also a discussion. It's like I wanted to do 3,000 actually, and you know, but that was kind of a discussion. The guys preferred 2,500, and that's a weird thing though because you don't know. Like, okay, the argument could be, well, we set 3,000, we don't make it, but at the same time, we set 3,000, maybe that would push more people to donate,
right?
Because it's still not like a huge difference. Not if we did like 10 grand, I would understand that would be a lot more, but like. So it could go either way, but we ended up settling on 25 anyways, and it was fine.
Did the money that you raised cover what you were expecting it would?
We still ended up having to put in, I don't know, around 1,000 to 1,200 total. But at the same time, it was 25 that we didn't have to come up with on our own.
Yeah.
Which is extremely helpful when, you know, and again, it makes it harder being in a... not just a metal band, but doing a specific subgenre of metal that at its core was really only around for about 5 years in the 90s.
Yeah. Let me just say in the liner notes, you have a quote in here. You said the passion that I feel for the classic melodic death metal sound is unparalleled. I truly value all of you who understand what I've been trying to accomplish. Right. So this whole album is really sort of like, It's got a whole theme to it, right?
Well, yeah. The music is obviously there's this passion there, but it's actually a concept album that my old vocalist and myself kind of worked up, and then he wrote all of the lyrics, and then obviously did the companion novel as well.
The genre, though, you said there was like a 5 year sweet spot for this genre. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so melodic death metal started in kind of like the, as early back as like 89 to 91. But then there was kind of like this time around the mid 90s where bands, specifically a band like called In Flames was making these really, really amazing albums. And they don't sound anything like they did back then anymore anyways. But those In Flames, Soilwork, At the Gates, Autumn Leaves, In Thy Dreams. You know, there was this Dark Tranquility, this core group of bands that specifically in the... So melodic death metal still exists today as a genre, but not many bands actually sound like they did in that time. And the reason why I mentioned those that get it, because they're the people that know what I'm trying to do, which unfortunately is there's a decent amount of people, but it's also still relatively small. So it's a total throwback genre.
Was it difficult for you to write that music for that? Because I mean, first of all, it's the album sounds great. I'm going to just keep complimenting you because the production sounds great, man. I know nothing about the genre of music. I know the music part of it. Like I could hear all the musicianship. It is very melodic. It's super listenable. Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly what we're talking about. So a lot of times people that don't know, people see melodic death metal and they just think death metal. And I'm sure even you wouldn't say it's a death metal album because I'm sure you've listened to at least heard death metal bands before. So what I always said as far back as I can remember from discovering the genre is I at least to somebody that isn't really in the know with as smaller bands, I always said it was kind of like a cross between Iron Maiden and Cannibal Corpse, where, you know, you have the death metal, but then you have these like really nice guitar harmonies and guitar leads and stuff like that. This very good, just melodic tone to the whole thing, even though it still has the harsh vocals and the heavier riffs and stuff like that. It's kind of a good mix.
So, yeah. Speaking of the harsh vocals, Adam, your singer on this album, How does he keep his voice? How does he keep from physically hurting his voice?
Actually, a lot of people ask me that, but he's been doing it for over 20 years.
So how does he do it? Like, when he talks to you, does he have a regular voice, or is it all like this?
I mean, he does kind of have a lower timbre to his voice, but I wouldn't say it's all dark and brooding. But I don't necessarily attribute having a low voice to having good vocals. There's just good ways of performing those style vocals.
That don't hurt you? That don't hurt your vocals?
That don't, yeah, there's ways to do it that don't hurt you. It's kind of similar to singing, where you're using a lot of the same muscles. Like, you want to push out that diaphragm. You don't want to use your throat, because that's where it will fuck you up. And it's just practice. And, you know, it's one of those things where you want to kind of keep in tune. And yeah, he had a great performance on the album.
And this concept album, like, I read the liner notes. I actually focused on, I love the introduction album, this first song on this Genesis, and then the song you wrote, Evolution of a Decaying Race. Dude,
just, oh, the lyrics, yeah.
Just reading the titles, yeah, the lyrics you wrote to that one, and you wrote all the music, I think, right?
I did, yeah, I wrote all the music to the whole album.
What's the concept behind this album? Can you tell me?
So the main concept is, it's kind of like a sci-fi thriller, I guess you could call it, or action thriller, where it's basically the resources on Earth have been depleted, and so they're trying to recolonize somewhere else in the universe. And basically the person that is running this is also trying to tell them that there's this place that they can go to, and where it's, they're gonna end up being able to
mess up that planet now too, right?
Yeah, basically, yeah. And there's a few, that's obviously a lot of little different elements there and stuff like that. That's the basic concept where, I mean, it's, you've seen it in sci-fi movies and stuff like that. It's not like we're not recreating the wheel with it, but
I mean, I have to say that my nephew Jackson, who, you know, he's the one who, I have to say, because I'm so interested in the music that he's interested in, because I'm so interested in his drumming, he taught me about this stuff. Like, I never knew about, like, nu metal and, like, anything death. Like, I would always just paint it with one brush and just push it aside, right? But now that I have a better understanding, I see the fun in it. He always tells me, he's like, Al, it's so fun. It's just, like, half of it is, like, just made up stuff. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. No, it's a very creative, I mean, music in general is a creative outlet, but I think that metal genres and metal musicians are sadly the most misunderstood of musicians.
I think you're right. Honestly, I was a misunderstander.
Yeah, but you also at least appreciate it. Like, you used to come to my old metal band shows and, like, From Beyond way back in the day and stuff like that, and so you'd still support, but there's also the other side of the spectrum where they're just like, the second they hear those harsh vocals, and it's just out for them, like, they won't even give it a chance, you know.
I totally understand that. I could see that happening. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Jordan Rannick.
And my name is Tyler Walsh.
And we are students at SUNY Fredonia's student record label. Today we'll be discussing some fun facts about Stevie Ray Vaughan's life and career, including his brief yet rocky relationship with David Bowie.
Stevie Ray Vaughan is best known for being the frontman of Double Trouble, an American blues rock band. Stevie Ray Vaughan was known to play guitar with the wrong end of the pick, playing with the heavier, thicker part. This was due to his heavy attack when playing guitar.
Stevie Ray and Bowie met at the 1982 Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland. At the festival, Stevie played Texas Flood and was actually booed by blues purists, which can be heard in videos taken from the festival.
Together, they created the 1983 smash hit Let's Dance, which is one of Bowie's fastest selling, entering the UK singles chart at number 5 on its first week of release, staying at the top of the charts for 3 weeks and topped the Billboard Hot 100. Becoming Bowie's first and only single to top the charts in both the US and the UK. It was also his second and last single to reach number 1 in the US.
The single became one of the best-selling of the year across North America, Central Europe, and Oceania. It is one of the 300 best-selling UK singles of all time. David Bowie subsequently invited Stevie Ray Vaughan to join him on tour, but it never came to pass. Stevie Ray was prohibited from promoting his debut album, Texas Flood, his wife was barred from rehearsals, and his band Double Trouble was never able to open up for Bowie, as was originally promised. Fed up, Stevie Ray, unable to reach Bowie, who was on vacation, quit on the eve of the tour and was replaced by Earl Slick.
Stevie Ray also had a very negative reaction to the video of Let's Dance, as it featured Bowie playing guitar in white gloves, which seemed very disingenuous. Stevie Ray was very vocal about his experiences with Bowie in regard to the music video and claimed, "That motherfucker shouldn't be pretending to play when he wasn't playing." Overall, their relationship, which started off great, turned sour fast. However, we have to thank Bowie for helping the great Stevie Ray reach even greater heights due to the exposure that Bowie gave him, though he is, of course, a legendary musician in his own right. And now it's time for some Stevie Ray trivia.
Question number one. At what age did Stevie Ray Vaughan form his first band? Question number two. At what age did Stevie first pick up guitar? And question number three. What stage name did he consider before using his real name? Stay tuned for the answers to Stevie Ray trivia at the end of this podcast.
So, I guess I want to talk a little bit about your guitar playing, because I'm curious. Your guitar playing is so good, it's so thoughtful, and it's so precise. And I actually think a person's guitar playing reflects their personality a lot.
I could see that.
And so, like, you also seem very patient, like, and thorough. Like, are you patient when it comes to writing and practicing and working on guitar?
Writing, yes. Practicing, no. I am not very regimented when it comes to actually practicing. I do have some finger exercises that I'll do before, like, band practice. But I should practice, like, practice more on a regular basis. Writing, I am, at least ever since The Last Rain, I have been very meticulous with my songwriting, because I knew I wanted to fit within this specific genre. So, I mean, I can't even tell you how countless riffs I've tossed out because I was like, it wasn't good enough. Or,
yeah, because I remember your solo project you did, right?
I mean, I have a few releases for that. I'm still technically doing it. It's just I'm very, very slow at it.
Well, it is a different genre. So it's very, you think it out, right? You plan it. And even the style of music, it's very cerebral, I think.
Yeah.
And you obviously approach your writing differently depending on what your project is, correct?
Well, I learned to do that a little bit better on, like, some of my newer acoustic songs, where, like, my first acoustic album, I was still acting as a metal guitar player writing acoustic music. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was a lot of guitar work on that first album, but then it also kind of made the vocals suffer a bit because I was still learning to sing and I wasn't even that great of a singer. I'm still not even that great of a singer, but I was writing these complicated rhythms and then tried to sing over them, which ended up a lot of common tone, you know, not a lot of variance in my vocals. But I've learned a lot from there. I've learned to let myself breathe a little bit on the guitar so I can I'll still use, like, interesting guitar parts. So it still has my own voice, but I do try to chill things out on the guitar a little bit to leave a little more room for singing.
Here's what I want to say. You're never going to be like, you're always going to be learning stuff. And maybe when you do turn 40, the one thing you can throw away is the concept of music has to equal somebody young doing it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was never the concept that somebody young to do it. It's harder to do an original band as you get older, because I don't want a band comprised of 20-year-olds, you know, but I still am one of not too many musicians my age that are willing to go on tour.
Yeah.
Or if the opportunity were to arise or things like that, you know, people have lives and stuff. That's not stuff that they want to do anymore.
I hear you. Yeah.
So that's why I wish that I had been this pursuant of this back in the, you know, when I was in my 20s, because it would probably have been easier to find people that would. Luckily, I have a group of guys that are willing to, at least to a point.
And that just makes perfect sense, though, because there's no way you can be young and know all this stuff because you have to live through it in order to learn it, right?
Right.
I mean, and that's just part of the whole process. It's being a musician is such a balancing act, like to find, you know, I guess the one thing I would say is, like, as I got older, I realized that there were other things that I like almost as much as music. And so I didn't have to put all my eggs in that basket, right?
Sure.
And that's good, but you also have to let go a little bit of that drive, that 100% all the time being thinking, living, working.
I still have a hard time letting go of that.
You do?
Oh yeah. And it's probably at the expense of my bandmates, because I want 100% of everything, you know, and because I do still have that drive. And like I said, I lucked out with the guys that are in the band because they are willing to do what they can, which is probably more than some other people our age might even be willing to do, which is, you know, might even be a fraction of that.
Yeah, I hear you. It is a balance. And by the way, I think it's great that you are always going to continue to do 100%, because all the best people, that's what they do.
Right.
There's no shame. There's no harm in doing that. It's a tight walk. We're like the what's that guy's name who walked on the tightrope over the Niagara Falls?
Walenda.
Yeah. What's his name?
Nick Walenda.
You have to live like a Nick Walenda when you're in the music business after what, 15 years. You got to start walking that tightrope a little bit to keep everything. You're walking the tightrope and juggling three things in the air, right? You're trying to make a living, trying to not be poor, trying to not give up your dreams, trying to be passionate about things, and trying to look ahead, right?
Yeah. This past year hasn't helped either. It's really taken the wind out of our sails.
Yeah, how have you done personally shutting down for a year? Has it been good for you or not good for you?
It's terrible. I mean, you know me. I'm an active, energetic person. I can't just sit at home and do nothing. You know, luckily the guys are, you know, we started practicing again probably in like June, but there was a solid 2-3 months where we just didn't at all, because obviously things are really bad back then. I'm generally stay pretty safe because my girlfriend Amy has some immune issues. So I've needed to stay even more cautious than I probably would have normally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do well with seclusion, you know, and not, like, you know, there would be those Saturdays where I'd revel in, like, hey, we get to hang inside and watch a movie for once, you know, let alone that being every fucking weekend now for almost a year. And I'm not built for that.
You're not built for that. I think it's probably the difference between extroverts and introverts. I talk about it a lot. I think about it a lot. And so I do think that extroverts have suffered more on a lot of levels during the shutdown.
For sure.
But we got through it. We're getting through it.
Slowly but surely.
You know what I think? I hope, like, as soon as, like, picture this summer, I think everybody's going to be super excited to start going to hear live music again. Just imagine how cool that's going to be, right?
I think that it'll definitely at least help in that regard.
It'll help the general malaise and apathy that we've been
right
for the past 10 years.
Yeah.
Just a couple more points I want to talk to you about, Brian. And one of them is, I ask people that I interview, can you identify someone who has really been someone you could call an inspiration? And you just immediately said Stevie Ray Vaughan. And I was thinking about it. I want to hear why you love him so much. And I want to know, like, if I'm thinking, like, really basic, the genres that you play and he plays are very different.
Right. Yeah, I know.
But there are some universal things that he does that I think probably appeal to somebody playing in any genre. And so tell me about that, because tell me about what you like about him, why he inspired you.
So you're right. Like, part of the reason why I wanted to mention Stevie Ray Vaughan is because I back when I started playing guitar, which was when I was around 13, I was taking lessons and kind of screwing around, and it just kind of came naturally to me. The strange thing was, so like, yeah, I took lessons for a little over a year, and I would bail a lot, and I didn't really practice, and any of that, blah, blah, blah. So then I don't know, I hit like a wall, and I put the guitar down, and I didn't play for like 6 months. And then I was watching VH1. Remember their Legends series? So there was the one on Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I had known who Stevie Ray Vaughan was before this. I mean, his story is incredible. You know, he's such a drive, and his enthusiasm, and obviously heavy on the drugs and alcohol. But what I really liked and found inspiring about it was, which was also kind of sad how it ended, was that in the late 80s, he completely turned his life around, got completely clean, no drugs, alcohol, and then within like a year or two, died in that plane crash. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it's just this devastating story, this turnaround, what happened. But anyway, so it's something, I don't know, something struck a chord, no pun intended, with me. And after the Legends episode ended, I went up and played my guitar for, I don't know, like 3 hours. And then I just literally haven't put it down since.
That's amazing. Like, when he played that guitar, I don't care if you were watching on a little tiny black and white TV, listening on the radio, seeing him live, which I actually saw him live once.
You did? Oh, I'm so jealous.
I didn't even know who he was. And it was at the LA Coliseum. And wow. He was opening for Jeff Beck. Anyways, he was amazing. It just blew me away. I didn't know one thing about him. I didn't know one of his songs.
Yeah, you wouldn't need to.
He had this thing that I imagine it would have been like for Jimi Hendrix, if we were around to hear that, you know, like, it just is undeniable, right?
It's funny you mentioned Hendrix, because obviously that's always the big debate, Hendrix or Vaughn, you know, and I was like, hands down, Vaughn, no contest, no contest. I don't know, like you said, it's just like this electric energy, and I'm not saying that Hendrix wasn't good, I just liked Vaughn's playing better. They're definitively different, even though they're still both blues players.
It's like you can feel somebody's spirit in their playing.
Right, yeah.
You name, if we're talking about guitarists, name the person, and you can feel their spirit coming through when they're authentic about it. And I think maybe something in his sort of spirit and approach resonated with you, just like it did with me or whatever, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, did you start playing his songs? Did you go in the blues route in the beginning?
No. No. Not at all. I actually only recently started playing Life by the Drop when I do my acoustic stuff, which actually he didn't even write. He just performed it. I never got into, I mean, I might've, oh no, there was, you know, there was a couple licks that I learned off of his Crossroads album, like Tightrope, the title track Crossroads. That was an album I really liked of his, which actually a lot of fans weren't a huge fan of. It was the album he did right after he got clean.
Okay. Yeah.
But it was, I always liked it. I always thought it was an excellent album.
Mm-hmm. All of his stuff is good. It doesn't matter what it is, right? So as far as you go, what inspires you? Do other players inspire you? Does music inspire you? Books, ideas, nature? What inspires you?
I would probably start with music. Obviously, this specific genre has definitely, you know, carried me for the last 5 years at least. Actually, I've always wanted to do a melodic death metal band, but I wasn't good enough as a player or objective enough
mm-hmm.
to be smart enough to know a good riff from a bad riff. You know, back when you're, you know, especially a lot of times when you're starting out writing for music, and I'm sure this is probably the way it was for you, you know, when you're starting out, you just write, oh, this is a cool riff, or at least you think it is. And, you know, be like,
yeah. And now, you know? It's almost unlistenable. I'm like, oh my God, right. How did anybody ever like me? Right. I get it.
Right. Yeah. So it's definitely music is a strong drive.
Do you ever get inspiration from other things? Like sometimes literally I get my best inspiration from words, from like books or a story or a movie or listening to what people say, like anything like that for you?
I do, but that would only lean more towards the lyrical side. Yes, I do get inspired by if I hear like a line from a movie or read something that's cool. A lot of times that'll spark lyrics and things like that. I wouldn't say those are the things that inspire me to write a literal song. It usually will just end up being lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the obvious, you know, relationship breakup stuff too.
That's always good for an album for me. Yeah.
You fill a catalog with that shit.
out of all the things you do, is there one that's your favorite, the process of it? I'm talking about writing songs, playing guitar, recording, performing live.
Performing live, hands down. You see me perform live.
I know, that's true. You do love it. And you're good at it.
And that's why this whole year has been so much harder for me, because outside of just being able to go out, we can't play shows, and that's my lifeblood.
Now that you say that, I didn't think of that, but you're right. That's true.
Yeah.
No wonder it's been so hard for you.
Yeah.
It's like taking off like one of your arms or one of your legs, right? It's a big piece of who you are.
Yeah.
I get that. All right. I'm going to let you go soon, but I have one more topic that we can't not cover. It's just that important.
I mean, I'm in no hurry.
You might be after you hear me ask you about this topic.
Okay.
Okay, the Joker. Tell me about this. Dude, I'm fascinated by this too. Can you just give the listeners a little back? When I say the Joker, what am I talking about? Give us the story.
Well, so you know what Tolex is, right?
No.
Tolex is what amps are covered in, like that kind of like vinyl material.
Okay, yep.
So I'm going to send you a text message.
Okay.
So I recently did some fancy stuff with my half stack.
Okay.
And I think you'll understand why I sent it just now.
Okay, got something. Oh, man. Dude.
Yeah. It's a lot of work, but it came out really good.
Can we use this picture in the podcast? Okay.
That's fine.
Okay. Go ahead. Now tell me about everything.
Obviously, you know, I've always been a comic book fan to start, you know. It's always a weird thing to say, but I always connected with the Joker as a character. It's outside of his, you know.
Outside of his evil, nefarious ways, yes.
Right, yes, that's that aspect. But, like, he always kept people guessing. Like, he was always doing something different. He was always doing something new. And you couldn't really pin it on him often because he was just so unpredictable. And I attribute that to me as a person because, like, I'm into so many different things. Like, I'm into, even just music alone, I'm into literally every genre under the planet. And I'm not one of those idiots that say, oh, I like everything, but then there's, oh, I don't like this or like that. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, and I, you know, I'm not saying that there isn't garbage music in every genre. I just think that there is something good in every genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but then like also, you know, an artist in other ways, you know, the graphic design, and I like to work out and exercise, and I'm into cosplay, and I'm into just a lot of different things. So I always feel like whenever I have conversations with people, at least people that haven't known me for a long time, they always seem to continue to learn something new about me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that river has run dry yet with anybody. So then from there, I wanted to do Joker as a Halloween costume for a long time, but I didn't want to do it until I had a girlfriend that was willing to do Harley Quinn. And years went by where pretty much no girlfriend that I had, including the plenty that you met over the years, just weren't into it. And I'm like, all right. So eventually the girl Cassie came along and she was willing to do it with me. Obviously we didn't work out. I finally get the chance to do this iconic thing that I wanted to. Now the only memory I have of it is with my ex-girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I randomly went and cosplayed at the Buffalo Comic Con in 2015 just to go, you know, just to meet people, do photos and stuff like that with people, whatever. It was really cool. It was neat because just that day alone was fun because people wanted photos with me and goofing around and stuff like that. And then I ended up meeting these people in the Superhero Alliance. And then over the course of maybe 4 years, I got to continue to portray the Joker. And
it's some high visibility places, right? Like,
yeah, in a lot. Like, obviously, we did Superhero Night for 4 years. Superhero Night 2, 3, 4, and 5, where I got to act as the Joker in them and be on the field and perform.
That's at the Bison's game, right?
Yeah, Bison Stadium. Yeah. And then Strong Museum Superhero Weekend. That was like a Saturday and Sunday where you're there all day and meeting all these people.
Are you in character? You're in character the whole time.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, not when, you know, we're having private conversations when we're just waiting for other people. But yeah, anytime somebody comes up to me, I'll always do the voice and scare the kids and all kinds of stuff. There's actually a really funny story. So that little vacation I was on last. Sorry, it wasn't last summer. It was 2 years ago. Down in Yogi Bear Park, out past Java, we had these two cabins that you can rent. But there was a different family that rented the other one, but they actually face into each other. We actually have like a shared fire pit, which is super weird, but they were super cool. Uh-huh. And they mentioned they were from Rochester. And I asked them, I was like, oh, you guys ever go to Superhero Weekend at Strong Museum? And they're like, yeah. And I was like, did you guys ever see a Joker there? He's like, yeah, I got a picture on my phone. He had me as the Joker on a picture on his phone with his kids.
Dude, how happy were they when you told them that's me? Then did they believe you?
No, they totally did. And they're like, they made a big thing out of it. They were like, oh, we kind of know a celebrity now.
Yeah, it's kind of a big thing because like this whole brave new world we're in, all these niche sort of markets are big deals, like Comic-Con and like even Buffalo Comic-Con was really big. And
it's cool to be a nerd nowadays.
That's the truth. We know the world is upside down when it's cool to be a nerd, right?
Yeah.
Brian, thank you for your time and thank you for all of your music and thank you for sharing a little bit about yourself.
And thank you for having me. And I always very much valued your friendship and your support through all these years. And you're an awesome person to know, Al.
Thanks, Brian. And so everyone, we're going to put some links up for The Last Rain, and we're going to put some links for where you can find and buy Brian's music. And I mean, honestly, he's a really super talented guy, and I appreciate your time tonight, Brian. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Yep, sounds great. Thanks, Al.
Thank you for listening. Here are the answers to the Stevie Ray trivia.
Question number one. At what age did Stevie Ray Vaughan form his first band? Stevie formed Blackbird at age 17 when he dropped out of high school and moved to Austin, Texas.
Question number two. At what age did Stevie first pick up guitar? 8 years old. It was Sears Western String Toy Guitar.
And the final question. What stage name did he consider before using his real name? It was Stingray.
We hope you enjoyed our fun facts about Stevie Ray and Bowie. We hope to catch you on the next podcast.
Well, there you have it. We hope you enjoyed listening. I have a request. Whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts, please subscribe, like, and share The Great Unsung. We need you. If you have questions or suggestions, please drop us a line at thegreatunsung@gmail.com. Thank you to Shannon Furtak for being a sounding board, a lifesaver, and an all-around emotional support human. And a big thank you to my awesome music industry students here at SUNY Fredonia, Jordan R., Jordan B., Kenny, Noah, Kona, Bailey, Tyler, Liam, Megan, Jenna, Amanda, Ivani, and David. Thanks, you guys, for all your hard work and for your creative ideas. And finally, dear listener, thank you for giving us a reason to talk about music and those of us who do it for a song.